The scientific attitude toward man is moving continuously from the obvious toward the subtle. We are beginning to recognize a network of intangibles lying behind the human personality. 25 years ago, the world was sharply divided between those who saw in man merely a highly perfected machine and those clinging to the spiritual foundations of our culture and resting their case upon the reality of the human spirit and soul. The interval between these two groups is only now beginning to be bridged. Working largely from the Aristotelian position of man's outer life, thoughtful individuals and learned orders and groups, seeking to unfold and advance basic human culture, are recognizing the mysterious background which lies behind the obvious conduct of the individual. We are now, therefore, developing a very common psychological problem, namely, wonder about mystery. And whereas not long ago we were certain of everything, now that mystery comes into the picture, we are uncertain of almost everything. In this uncertainty, our psychological schools have divided and further divided until we can no longer find any common terminology which with reasonable precision defining their various attitudes. This probing into the source of things makes it convenient also to re-examine ancient forms of knowledge. And whereas 50 years ago, mythology, fable, legend belonged only to certain art or culture groups, we are now examining it to discover, if we can, other keys to the internal life of the individual. Along the same line, we are beginning to be aware of the workings of ancient sciences. We are still inclined to assume that most of these sciences were psychological, particularly in the fields of therapy. We are still not convinced that all ancient remedies were as effective as they seem to be. Perhaps a great faith, a strong and ardent dedication to beliefs, helped these remedies. And we are thinking now in terms of the importance of this ardent belief in helping us in the various fields of our problems. We have noted that the ancient man seemed to be able to believe more easily than we do because he lived in a world of mysteries and wonders. Modern man has a hard time becoming a devout believer in anything because he lives in a world of so many critical opinions, so many cynical attitudes, and so much that passes for sound and solid knowledge. He is finding, however, that the lack of the ability to believe is weakening him, making him less able to carry the daily burden of life. As he de-glamorizes every part of his culture, he finds himself dying for lack of a little glamour. Now we have a reaction here, but we have now transferred our instinct toward glamour, toward hero worship, toward objects that are not really satisfactory. We are discovering that movie stars, prize fighters, and orchestra leaders, as subjects for glamour, are not quite so efficient or successful as the ancient gods or the muses or the prophets of old. All our glamour has become so materialized that it carries with it very little internal contribution to our strength. Digging back into all these old beliefs and ideas, we come to one of the earliest of them all, and that is a word which up to 10 years ago was anathema in the field of science, and that word is astrology. It was held to be one of the most ancient of man's vulgar superstitions, held to have no foundation in validity of any kind, and a great many second-rate astronomers have made careers out of belittling it and attacking it. Actually, however, as we have noted before, the subject has never been subjected to actual scientific analysis, even by our so-called scientific method. There is no field of belief in which there has been so much prejudice and so few facts. Taking the attitude, in general, that the concept was in conflict with our daily thinking and with the latest discoveries of science, it has been empirically rejected. Actually, we are not sure that this conflict exists, but we would like rather to assume that it does than to add the slow and laborious procedure of investigating carefully and thoroughly. Again, however, the development of television and the perfection of radio devices, perfection of device, not program, we are sorry to note, has caused us to realize that there are a great many intangible forces operating in our lives. Radio and television, perhaps more than wireless telegraph, which preceded these, has opened to our consciousness the reality of things unseen. We are now willing to accept that this atmosphere in which we live may be a tremendous area of energy transmissions. We are willing to assume that through this room and through our own bodies, waves of energy are constantly moving, invisible to us. But we are not quite sure that their invisibility means that they have no effect upon us. If this effect has to be in terms of body impact, we can deny it. But if behind this body is an energy field, not so different from these very energies moving in space, are we certain that these universal energies have no effect upon our internal energies? Are we able to say with certainty that we are living in a universe of vital force, and yet we are immune to so many aspects and phases of this force, even though the force itself we must accept as the very source of our life? Thinking a little further in this particular field, we are now confronted with radiation, and to a degree with fallout. Radiation is much more subtle. We can imagine that fallout consists of minute material substances which can variously poison or contaminate us. But in terms of radiation, we are again in the presence of an invisible energy. And yet we are now convinced that this energy can kill, that it does affect us. And studies of the universal spectrums of various parts of cosmos and space now indicate that radiation is pouring in upon us in many, many ways. Not long ago, a scientist pointed out that we are continuously in a field of radiation that is actually more dangerous than the atomic bomb. This field of radiation, coming to us from the sun and from other parts of space, would have destroyed us utterly had we not gradually, over millions of years, adapted ourselves to this kind of energy. So that we are living in a field of death, living because we have adapted ourselves to death and have come to survive its immediate consequences. With this type of thinking, therefore, the possibility that man lives in a world of energies is not nearly as mysterious as it used to be, or as difficult to accept. Nearly always, and this is true of all sciences, we have to break through old superstitions and unfounded interpretations in order to come to the substance of a thing. But let us not imagine for a moment that the stargazers of old were unique in their ability to befuddle their own subject. Today, in practically every branch of learning, the greatest menace is the expert. This individual is so set in his own ideas and so certain of his own methods that for every fact we discover, we add at least 3 or 4 new superstitions for our memory to struggle with. Today, we are encrusting nearly all of our modern branches of learning with interpretations and explanations that will be obsolete in 10 years. If, therefore, the subject of astrology has been exposed to human interpretation and misinterpretation, as Dr. Budge of the British Museum points out, for nearly 35,000 years, it is quite conceivable that it would have accumulated a number of elements and factors which may have to be sloughed off in the search for facts. Yet over this same period of time, all of those working with the subject have used the same identical basic machinery. And as is also pointed out by Dr. Budge, the interpretations used today are identical in principle with those found on the cuneiform Chaldean tablets that go very far back into the reign of Hammurabi among the Babylonian peoples. The same essential procedures, the same structures, with the possible exception of mathematics, upon which the whole subject depends. There is no other branch of learning that has survived so long without being completely reconstructed. It might therefore seem possible that there was certain validity that is unchanging, moving under the surface of the various national systems of divination, which we have now come to regard as pseudosciences, and to consider as hardly worth scientific thought. We are not nearly so sure anymore that these are worth so little attention. Another interesting and significant factor is the wide distribution of these beliefs. It has been said, and perhaps not untruly, that no culture system has ever attained maturity without the belief in the influence of the heavens upon the earth and man. India, China, Persia, Greece, Egypt, practically every great culture that we have known has held this belief. And up to the last 500 years, it has been for the most part held with esteem. And it was certainly regarded most affectionately by the great astronomers of Europe, to whom we are indebted for our new, emancipated astronomical theories. I refer to men like Kepler, Galileo, Copernicus, Brahe. These men, who were themselves the great patron saints of modern astronomical knowledge, they were all astrologers, including Kepler. This concept means that a thoughtful mind can also accept this idea. Perhaps it was lost to us with the rise of the great 19th century materialistic system. It could not then be fitted in, because man could not, under the dictum of science, believe what he could not see or accept what could not be demonstrated in a laboratory. Unfortunately, however, he made no consistent effort to demonstrate, and therefore found it easy to reject something that he was not even interested in considering. Again, perhaps, the tremendous competition in the mind of man between antiquity and the modern world, the reluctance that we have to assume that other peoples or other ages have had knowledge that was important. We more or less hate to admit this. We like to feel that we are unique in every field of discovery. And one some East Indian scholar and scientist, in this case Nobel Prize winner, tells us that the Hindus were using electricity and making batteries 7,000 years ago, we are more than astonished. We are humiliated. We are offended. It is a personal grievance. And the first thing we must do is to prove that it is not true. It is to us more important to disprove these things than to investigate them. A small opening has been made in this wall of attitude on the level of medicine. Here we observe more and more expeditions going out into the field to study primitive medicine among aboriginal, savage peoples. And from some groups and tribes that are still, or up to recently have been, headhunters, we have made important medical discoveries. We have learned of herbs and simples, of various materials used to combat specific ailments. And out of the primitive lore of the medicine man, the voodoo doctor, and the juju magician, we are gaining information that will help Americans to live longer. At first, this was also so humiliating, no one dared to think about it. Today, however, we have a slightly improved attitude because we are all uncomfortable and are seeking remedies. And it has dawned upon us that it is better to have the remedy than keep the prejudice. Took a long time to get this far. This may be termed a major step in culture, a step towards better times for all of us. The development of psychology has brought with it considerable interest in the intangible sources of human energy supply. It has caused us to become aware of this dream life behind the individual. And the classification, as we have advanced it, of the various forms of phenomena emerging from man or moving through man has increased our respect for the mysterious plus X in the root of man. At one time, we were certain that this selfhood in man was nothing more or less than the byproduct of irritation in the cerebral processes, that the individual, becoming mad enough, became a person. We are not quite certain of this anymore, either. We are beginning to think more and more in terms of the person living in the body, and we have suddenly come to the realization that an unseen, invisible, immeasurable quantity, which we call self in man, is responsible not only for his actions, but for this vast and wonderful conglomeration of attainments which we call the modern way of life. We are suddenly realizing that the skyscraper, that the atomic projectile, the airplane, all of these things emerge from something scientifically beyond access. That from man, as an invisible core, something not to be weighed or analyzed chemically, there is flowing constantly streams of inspiration, intuition, knowledge, thought, reason, and ingenuity, which pay off in terms of immense discoveries, tremendous conveniences, and innumerable inconveniences. Whatever this is in man is not an unmixed blessing. It is capable not only of making a tremendous contribution, but of gradually transforming man into the problem child of history. With this gradually increasing respect for invisibles, science must ultimately turn its attention to new levels of demonstration. It must discover new sciences of itself, or restore them out of the past, by means of which it can approach reasonably, rationally, and so far as is possible scientifically, the mystery of the invisible at the root of all visible things in nature. Until it achieves this, it can never move from the sphere of effects to the world of causes. And all effects are suspended from adequate causes in nature. We like to think, of course, that visible effects are practical and invisible causes are impractical. Yet how shall we say that that is impractical, which, though unseen, becomes the power behind all practical works and labors? It is like some mysterious moral force, like man's urge to love. We cannot define it, we cannot explain it, but whatever good we have in our world has come from it. And the failure of this is the most dismal failure that can occur within the structure of human life. So we have these intangibles, and we must approach them scientifically. We must have something more than a grand admiration. We must be able to learn useful ways, useful applications, and also a proper framework upon which to build a common science of human understanding. Going back, therefore, to this rejected field of what we might almost call astrophysics, we are astonished to find a carefully organized field of symbols, of emblems and figures, of processes and formulas that have come down from the past. It would be astonishing indeed if so many thoughtful persons over so many thousands of years should have been completely addicted to a chimera. It is almost incredible that we could have so scientifically organized imagination. And at the same time, all things have to be tested by their utilities. And it is hard also to imagine that something which had no foundation in fact and was merely a flight of imagination could possibly have sustained itself so long in common admiration. Nor could it have vindicated itself as frequently as it has done by the accuracy of its methods and pronouncements. Thus we are in the presence of something, and in the study of ourselves we discover that these ancient peoples evolved a very comprehensive idea. We do not have to accept it, but I think it is time for us to examine it and try to discover, if possible, whether we are in the presence of a valuable key. Certainly, these people taught, these old stargazers taught thousands of years ago, that what we call the empty air around us is actually a kind of channel through which energy is continuously moving. They taught us this while, for the most part, we had the dimmest concept of the meaning of energy. They believed, and in practice still apply the belief, that man is in the midst of an immense complex of forces, and that in some mysterious way these forces converge upon his internal life. And that from this convergence there are modifications in his nature and temperament, by means of which his outer life is also conditioned. Perhaps one of the simplest ways of trying to understand this is by the recognition of certain common, observable phenomena. Most persons are aware of the old family almanac, which was of the greatest meaning and significance to our farmer ancestors. The farmer secured his annual almanac with religious devotion and dedication. Back in the beginning of our national life, Benjamin Franklin printed the almanac and George Washington bought it in order to use it in the maintenance of his plantation. Men like Washington and Jefferson and Hamilton would not for a moment have thought that it was possible to maintain a farm without an almanac. Now, this almanac contained a quantity of astronomically and astrologically calculated information relating to planting, relating to the harvesting, and of course also to the general climatic condition of the year. Some of you probably have known farming people, perhaps were raised on farms yourselves, and it would be quite obvious that a shrewd and canny farmer, and farmers are not foolish, would not have for years depended upon these almanacs for the regulation of his planting and protection against sudden inclemency of weather, unless he had justified to himself that it worked. These people were shrewd. They were not even wasting 5 cents on an almanac, unless it meant something. And they certainly would not follow it long if the result was the loss of their crops. But that these things actually did have bearing upon planting has later been proved under scientific conditions in Arizona, where planting various vegetables at different phases of the moon shows distinct effect. That these influences do have some bearing. St. Thomas Aquinas, the great Catholic philosopher of the Middle Ages, pointed out that it would be incredible to assume that the moon, which it has the power to draw the waters of the earth and to establish the tidal rhythm of the seas, that such a powerful influence has no effect on anything except water. Assuming also that it had no effect upon anything except water, let us remember that the human body is over 85% water. If it can move the tides, this lunar influence, has it any effect upon the liquids and humors of the human body? Studying tree rings, we observe distinctly the cycles of sunspot maxima in the tree. And it is possible to find out from the study of tree rings the dating on cycles of sunspot maxima. Of course, we have easier ways of dating, but it could be done by that means. Is it conceivable, therefore, that a force which will leave a continuous and almost indestructible record of itself within the heavy woody fiber of a tree, that this has no effect on anything else? We know also the effect of these motions of energy in space upon the great cycles of financial adversity and promotion in the affairs of men. It has been noted for years that the stock exchange, both the one in England and the one in the United States, the principal stock exchanges, all can be graphed according to planetary and luminary cycles. Now, even if we wish to assume that the planets have no effect upon man and only on the stock exchange, can you imagine anyone who is not affected, directly or indirectly? Whenever we come to this recognition, we must come also into the realization of the interdependence of living things. And we must realize that anything or any force which can change the fur on rabbits or can result in the development of these tree ring circles must influence profoundly the interior energies of something. It is difficult to assume that all this influence is merely from the outside. We are not able at any moment to check this influence. But after a period of years, we perceive it. And we are suddenly aware of a very subtle form of energy modifying the conditions under which we exist. The Greeks held to this concept also. And Plato's great cyclic year and his various periods of alternating fertility and sterility, by means of which the cultures of humanity are so profoundly affected. These observations remain true. The various phenomena which Plato described actually occur. But how shall we understand it? Not having a better explanation, is it conceivable that he could have been right, as he was in so many things? Could a man whose knowledge of politics, government, human philosophy, and religion be as profound as it was, and have survived so long to our admiration, been completely naive in something else of equal importance? It is hard to imagine that he could have been. And certainly we have no right to take it for granted. We must, therefore, at least make honest investigation. This brings us, perhaps, to one of our important psychological points. Namely, that as we know from the seasons that the energy availability differs at different parts of the year due to the inclination of the Earth's axis, we know that this is true because we can watch the coming of winter, and we can watch its disappearance again after the vernal equinox. We see the larger part of the Earth affected by this. We measure it in terms of human adjustment and non-adjustment. And today, parts of our eastern seaboard are blanketed in snow. We are not so blanketed here. Other parts of the world are now preparing for the glories of summer, such as our neighbors in Australia. These differences, we know, are due to astronomical phenomena. And we know that these differences affect the birth rate. We know they affect the death rate. And we recognize that untimely situations arising in the world's climate affect us economically, in the destruction of crops, affect us in the terms of health. Any physician will point out to you the seasonal epidemics. Also, we know the vulnerability of the sick. And we recognize that millions of people today are leaving extreme climates and gathering in our own delightful Southern California smog-infested atmosphere because they are tired of facing pneumonia every winter. This situation is obviously the result of a chemistry of universal factors. If the sun were not where it is, if the planets were not where they are, and if the Earth was not in its present position among them, this entire group of circumstances would be totally changed. And man himself could do nothing about it. For in the presence of these elements, man as a person is hopeless and helpless. That these things, therefore, pound upon his outer life, we know. So we are presented at this time with two possible psychological schools of thought. One is that the effect of universal energy modifications upon man are due first to the effect upon his environment. There is no doubt that religions are the results of longitude and latitude. If the Finns had not lived where they lived, they would not have given us that beautiful, classical, religious, mythological poem, the Kalevala. If the Hindus had not been exactly where they were, they would not have given us the peculiar interpretation of Hinduism that we have today. If the Japanese had lived somewhere else or under different conditions, they would not have had the peculiar flowery arts with which we associate them. Thus, the distribution of climates may definitely and does certainly affect body structure, social adjustment, degree of activity. It has a strong effect upon ambitions, motivations, and upon the contemplative interior life of the person. Thus, if man is the result of the town in which he lives, the books he reads, the friends he meets, and the relatives he has accumulated, so he is also subject to the seasons, the weather, the climate, the terrain in which he exists. Mountain people are different from valley people. And it is quite conceivable that this vast, intangible atmosphere, which is actually constantly modifying our way of life, may also be moving in upon us as a psychological factor in our temperament and our disposition. Thus, merely the fact that the sun and the moon and the stars are in the sky has affected us. It has affected our religions, and in turn these have moved our living. The contemplation of the sunset affects man, whether we wish to say it is the sunset itself or the contemplation of it. May be a psychological point, but it has had its effect and has come down to us in the personification of the sunset in a whole cycle of gods and goddesses and heroes. These, in turn, have affected our moral lives. And to a measure, our moral lives are in continuous and stressful relationship with economic existence. These things affect. Consequently, if we wish to say that the universe produced the environment by which man is what he is, we are only making another statement of the power of universals upon the life of individuals. Now, we know that man's actual existence, along with the existence of everything else that does exist, is due to participation in a life principle, that through man constantly something electric, magnetic, some strange life fluid essence pours and flows continuously, that in this essence also man has his existence, in the light and the air and space around him. For every part of himself that is tied to the earth, there are countless parts tied to space. We have become so accustomed to watch our feet and think of the solid earth beneath as a symbol of all reality that we have forgotten that were we and are we separated from the space energy by which life is maintained, we would simply and do simply pitch forward upon the earth dead. Thus our lives come to us out of life itself. And how shall we observe or assume that life reaches us? Are we to follow with the ancients that believe that the life of man really originates in the living spiritual being that ensouls the planet? Or are we willing or more inclined to assume that it arises from the tremendous energy fields in which this planet floats, suspended itself by one of the greatest mysteries of energy and motion? Thus assuming, and we must assume, we have no choice, that our energies by which we can lift a hand, read a book, take a step, that these energies are invisible, but absolutely real, and that without these energies, we have no achievement, no existence possible. We have the telephone. We have the instrument on the wall or on our desk. We know that it is tied with a mass of wires and a network of stations and substations to phones all over the world. Yet if the current that moves within these wires and carries the message ceases, the telephone ceases to be important, although its physical structure remains undisturbed. It ceases to live. It is dead. Therefore, the energy which we cannot see is really a kind of divine power, and the instrument made for that energy is our acceptance of the reality of that power, and our desire to build a house for it, whereby it can live with us and serve us. But the instrument is the servant of the energy. Without the energy, the instrument is meaningless. And in the same way, the human body, about which we boast so much and so continuously, is an instrument. And without the energy that ensouls it, it is meaningless. It is unable to achieve any of the purposes for which it is intended. Now, we have not yet reached a point in popular thinking where it has occurred to us that this energy upon which we live may come to us in a conditioned form. We are fully aware that there are many energies in space, that there are planetary rays, solar rays, cosmic rays. We are now recognizing that we have a universe like a very intricately woven fabric, the very substances of this fabric being composed of energy, that this energy is subject to innumerable laws of its own kind, and that there is also various adjustments and conflicts between the laws of energy and the laws of matter. These facts are dimly coming to our attention. But now comes the gravest question that we know. This energy stream that sustains us, is it a pure, unconditioned stream? Is there nothing between this life principle and body? If there is anything between, what is it? Is there some reason, some archetypal pattern governing the distribution of this energy according to laws, according to principles, according to values? If such government exists, in what is it posited? What is the universal machinery by means of which the specializations, diversifications of energy are possible?